On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
You maybe modify that ketogenic diet in the way that I did after the test, which would be to not restrict carbohydrates to the extent to where you're getting some physiological blowback. And so for Ironman, like there was a certain point where I'd switch to just like full on sugar. So we have this rift in society, right? We have the healthy people hanging out with healthy people and the unhealthy or fat people hanging out with fat people. What then needs to occur, you have to start inviting your unhealthy friends or your overweight friends to these same type of events, but just make sure they're always outnumbered.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits, and inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
So I guess we're recording.
Yeah, we're recording.
Okay. This is going to be interesting because you just gave me this this skin food. This is your product, Brian. This nose-to-tail stuff. So the ingredients, I've been out in the sun doing a photo shoot all day because I'm a hot fitness model. And so my skin's probably a little bit dry, or at least UVA and UVB'd. So I'm just going to put some of this in my face. Grass-fed tallow, avocado. I thought you told me this was all nose to tail, you bastard. It's got plants
in it. I snuck some. Saladino would be.
Yoga oil. It's going to kill me. Bergamot, frankincense. Oh, so it's psychedelic. Yes. Cedarwood. All right. Well, I'll smear this on my face. I actually, I used to use extra virgin olive oil. Do you do this podcast as a video also?
Yeah. We got it. Getting
a video. I used to do extra virgin olive oil on my face just because it was easy to walk into the pantry and do it. And I figured if I was buying olive oil anyway, it works really well. And then I realized because I had some like beef tallow. You could do beef tallow. I've experimented with ghee. Ghee doesn't work because it has like that butyric acid smell. It's kind of like farty smelling. Coconut oil isn't bad.
Coconut's good.
Beef tallow is like
so. This is good. So this is whipped too. You know, it's like a whipped texture, and so it's just and some essential oils.
I just put it on my skin, and the whole time I was putting it on my skin, I thought this was like a food product that you gave me. So now I don't feel quite as dumb.
No, it is. You're supposed to put it on your skin. It's food for your skin.
It's got grass fed tallow. That's like the metric for a healthy beauty. What do you call it? A beauty-ceutical? Cosmeceutical?
If you can eat it.
I forget what you call it. If you can eat it.
Yeah. No, that's what we're doing. It's grass fed, grass finished suet. And
probably still tastes like shit, but you could eat it.
Well, I would imagine. My dog might start licking you. But, yeah.
And then what else? We've got this plant-based tonic. You haven't had this before, Brian, but Khalil, my friend at Sun Life Organic this morning. Well, no, last night I had a dinner and he gave me a shot of this stuff. It's called Feel Free. I'm not sponsored by them or anything. This isn't a ploy. It's called Feel Free. And it's basically kava, which is like kind of the relaxing thing, which you know all about because you're from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But then it's got kratom in it, which is kind of interesting. Kava and kratom, because kratom is like a non-opioid based painkiller. That's why most people use that. And sometimes for sleep or sometimes for energy, depending on the strain. And then kava is basically just like it's muscle relaxant.
It's a relaxer. Yeah.
It's like a euphoric muscle relaxant. So I asked Khalil, I'm like, how do you feel if you take this? And he said, you feel euphoric. And then I went to their website and it said, you feel euphoric. Maybe that's why they call it Feel Free. And so I had a shot last night before dinner, and I also had a cocktail, admittedly. But I felt like I'd had like four or five cocktails, but not like clumsy. I was lucid, but relaxed. And so you and I are drinking this right now on ice. I just did a shot yesterday, but it took like 20 or 30 minutes for me to kind of like feel it.
I'm already feeling
this,
it.
This whole shit might go south in like 20 minutes.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. Maybe we'll get really mellow. Numb? My tongue is numb.
Yeah.
I know, I'm feeling good. Yeah. Well, let's kick this off. You mentioned alcohol. So it may or may not have been my birthday last night, and I may or may not have drinking alcohol.
Really? It was your birthday last night?
Yeah.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thanks.
How old are you?
I'm 38.
Oh, I got you beat by a year.
Uh-huh. Wow. See, this is my goal is to look young. I feel like we're doing a good job of it.
Yeah.
Staying in shape.
Yeah. You look pretty well preserved.
I'm trying.
That's all it makes you sound like a mummy. Well preserved.
So, you're kind of like a biohacking guy. I'm trying to coin the phrase ancestral hacking.
Ancestral hacking.
Instead of biohacking.
That's a lot more syllables than biohacking.
It is. It's not. It doesn't roll off your tongue. But it's like what biohacking does kind of mimics our ancestral environment, right? That's what I think it should do.
Some of it, like the red lights mimic infrared from the sun, or the grounding mats and the grounding shoes mimic earthing or grounding, or a cryotherapy chamber mimics cold water, or a sauna might mimic like a hot afternoon day. But then there's some things like a hyperbaric chamber.
You get it closer.
Is that better?
Yeah.
I've done this only a couple times before. like a hyperbaric chamber. It's kind of like, what does that simulate? Like, how often was ancient man like 30 feet? No, like 30 feet under
below.
The water
at
high oxygen or same thing, like altitude training, like the hypoxic training devices, the Live O2, that would be an example of a biohack, or like a fitness biohack, like a Vasper, where you have your arms and legs occluded and you're exercising and you have cold. And so I think that there's a sector of biohacking that's mimicking natural living or what our ancestors might have done, and allowing us to more efficiently do that, sometimes in a shorter period of time, in a post-industrial era in which we are kind of fighting an uphill battle where we might have to work indoors. So we need red light panels indoors, or we aren't sleeping in a cave, so we need like a grounding mat on our bed, or there's like glass and needles and syringes on the dirty Austin streets, so you need to wear like big built-up rubber-soled shoes, and so you put grounding straps on your shoes, and those would all, I think, fall under the category of mimicking in a post-industrial era using smart science, what our ancestors would have gotten through natural means, or what we can and should also get through natural means that we top off with those biohacks. But I do think there's like some other biohacks, like some of the stuff I mentioned, like, you know, the hypoxic training devices or the Vasper or a hyperbaric chamber or like stem cell injections, you know, mm-hmm. some of that stuff. Yeah. Like that's on, like level. Modern science yeah. stuff that our ancestors wouldn't have done.
Well, I appreciate that stuff. So I'm just more into the ancestral hacks. I'm trying to do that. It's like a more natural version. Like instead of getting all these gadgets, like sleep rings and this and that, I'm trying to just do it more naturally. But yes, there is a next level that I appreciate. And that's what you are more of an expert in.
Right? Well, nature threw me a big fat clue that maybe I'm not supposed to be using a wearable yesterday because I went swimming in Barton Springs. And you know, when you swim, your appendages kind of shrink a little bit. You know, there's shrinkage, mm-hmm. not just crotchage shrinkage, but shrinkage of the digits and uh-huh. the toes. And I got like 20 minutes into my swim and my Aura ring is now at the bottom of Barton Springs.
Well,
it's a size 13, like $400 stealth black Aura ring for any of you Austinites who want to go underwater metal detecting like Gollum from Lord of the Rings
yeah.
and come up with my precious. Wow. So yeah, so I lost my Aura ring yesterday, but I like the idea of unplugging to a certain extent, like you've just talked about. Brian McKenzie, and I think it was Kelly Starrett was his co-author. I think it was Kelly Starrett, and I think it was Brian McKenzie, and I could be wrong, but they wrote a book called Unplugged a few years ago about, you know, all the uses of heart rate variability monitors and power meters and mm-hmm. stride rate metrics and, you know, muscle force meters used in fitness, and how sometimes we can lose touch with the signals that our own body is telling us in that type of scenario. Kind of mm-hmm. like the classic, I woke up, I feel great, I had a wonderful night of sleep. I look at my wearable, it tells me my sleep was shitty and it was really 6 hours and I'm supposed to be tired today. And so suddenly I have a crappy workout because my ring or my mm-hmm. watch told me I was supposed to have a crappy workout. And I certainly think that we risk that. When I was racing Ironman triathlon, mm-hmm. I raced for Team Timex. And Timex, of course, hooked us up with like the, you know, the $1,000 supercomputers the size of a pager that we wear on our wrists and the electric bike meters for power and the things we wore in our shoes for stride length and even like pretty advanced stuff like stride rate, push off, you know, power, everything for running and metrics for swimming, you know, even like the swim goggles that display your stroke rate and stuff to you, like on the back of the goggle screen as you're swimming. And I got like 2 years in the racing with them and I just burnt out on all that stuff. I was like, I just want to go back to my cheap ass $15 Timex and just like kind of pay attention to how I feel when I'm running and pay attention to how I feel when I'm cycling. Not because I think those other training metrics and training technologies are bad or not useful, but I got to the point where I just kind of burnt out on all that stuff. And now I'm very selective about what I wear and what I track. And especially for me, like the biggest one is when I'm exercising. I just don't like to be wearing a lot when I'm exercising. Mm-hmm. Like I wear the ring and I don't, you know, I used to just like track HRV and recovery and every weight I'd lifted and all my sets and all my reps and, you know, the Strava distance and all that stuff. I just like to move now and unplug, and it feels really refreshing. If I was a pro athlete or if I was coaching a pro athlete, I'd have a different approach. Mm-hmm. But if you're just trying to live healthy and be natural, you know, you don't need all that stuff really.
Well, you know what? I think it's good to start off with something like that. Like, you know, like Levels gave me a CGM to try out for free. Right. And yeah. it was great. So for 2 weeks, or actually I worked for a month.
Continuous glucose monitor.
Yeah. yeah. So for a month I tried it and I tried different foods and I learned a lot. Right. And I tried, like, if I ate sourdough bread, it was, you know, slow fermented. It was the right kind of bread. It spiked way more than potatoes.
It spiked more
than potatoes, the
although theoretically the sourdough bread should have a lower glycemic index, right?
So I don't know. Wow, this drink's hitting me, actually.
Is it? Yeah. No. So. Move your lips.
But for me, I mean, I know it's variable per the person, but I just think, but it's like the bread is more refined food, I think.
It can be, but a couple things to think about that, especially for like our listeners who are using a continuous glucose monitor, and this is really interesting, is let's say that on paper, slow fermented sourdough bread
has a lower glycemic index than like Wonder Bread or regular bread, mm-hmm. and a lower glycemic index on paper than a potato, assuming you're not talking about a potato that's been cooked and cooled mm-hmm. and taken out to form resistant starch, yeah. which is a cool way to kind of like yeah. hack a potato or rice. But, and let's say that's the case on paper. But the interesting thing is, where's the wheat from? Like, is there glyphosate, herbicide, pesticide exposure that would be causing a sympathetic nervous system response that would actually cause your liver to start mobilizing blood glucose as a stress response? Do you have a food allergy or food intolerance to gluten or gliadin or other wheat proteins that you don't have to potatoes that would produce a similar effect? You know, for example, you know, like Tim Ferriss is super into the slow carb diet. Mm-hmm. And legumes would be considered a slow carb food, and green beans would be considered one of those legumes. And I was consuming green beans as not a staple in my diet, but I would probably have green beans like once or twice a week. And I got one of those continuous blood glucose monitors and I started tracking, and my blood sugar would spike over and over again when I'd have these green beans, which are supposed to be a slow carb food that wouldn't spike your blood sugar. And, then I did one of these food allergy tests called a Cyrex panel, which is a pretty good, like a gold standard food allergy test. Yeah. They test via the blood, the white blood cell reaction to both the raw and the cooked version of the protein. And then they have a special testing protocol where they'll do like back to back tests. And it's really gold standard. It doesn't result in like a laundry list of false positives for your food allergies. And the only thing, like I was pretty clean across the board, but the only thing that I flagged really high for was green beans. Mm. And so now I'm like, oh, well, it's not just the glycemic index of a food that dictates how it's going to affect your blood glucose. It's not just the bacterial profile in your stomach, which in your gut, which we also know will affect your blood glucose response to foods based on the day two studies in Israel. But it's also whatever your sympathetic nervous system is doing in response to that food. Which gets super wild if it's like, well, maybe you're, I don't know, let's just say like you're divorced and you have a really, you had a really unpleasant divorce and your partner had like a certain food, like chicken that they cooked for you. And now you're like, your blood glucose spikes in response to chicken. So there could even be like a psychosomatic component. So that's why I think sometimes testing can tell you a lot of stuff that you really, really wouldn't realize just intuitively from books or whatever.
That's interesting. Or even like if people eat on the go and they're driving and they're like, that's like you're stressed out. Your body's like in a stressed state and you handle foods differently.
It is. I think it is so underemphasized the importance of eating in a parasympathetic state. Now, of course I'm very much a proponent of chewing your food, you know, 25 to 40 times, saying grace or doing breath work or both prior to a meal, sitting down rather than standing when you eat, not commuting when you eat, but I've become so cognizant of the change in my bowel function, the gas, the bloating, the undigested food particles I can see in my stool, and all the things that happen if I've consumed a meal when I'm on the go. When you combine that with the fact that I don't even really enjoy meals that I consume, like if I make myself an amazing smoothie and I drink it while I'm like headed to a doctor's appointment versus like drinking it while I'm sitting at home, like reading some cool news, which is like, because if I'm eating by myself, which I do sometimes at home and not with my family, I'll choose activities that are more passive while I'm eating, like reading the paper, thumbing through a magazine, you know, reading a cool blog post, that type of thing. And I am highly cognizant now, and I think a lot of people really should be, about whether or not I'm in a sympathetic or a parasympathetic state when I'm consuming food. And of course, back to the metrics tracking, you could use something like a heart rate variability monitor, and just until you really, really know, only like don't eat until you figured out how to get your heart rate variability high before you eat. With, of course, the only exception being people who are like ultra endurance athletes who have to eat while they're exercising. The worst my gut's ever been in my life was when I was racing triathlon and had to eat while I was exercising. And not only that, but the increased gut permeability that occurs when you're exercising becomes even greater when you're exercising in the heat. And so I would be like mowing down power bars while riding my bike in 90 degrees. And yeah, I needed those calories theoretically. I mean, even if you're like ketogenic fat,
that's burning, what I was going to ask.
Whatever you still need. I mean, like you're still burning appreciable amounts of glycogen. Like to the like a lot of people are like, oh, you're just riding your bike for endurance, bro. I'm like, no. Like if I got to tackle a hill and I'm pushing out 500 watts on a hill or during a race, I've got 20 seconds to pass somebody, which is the allotted time to do so. Mm-hmm. Or at least it was when I was racing Ironman. I'm burning huge amounts of glucose. And therefore you need a throughput of glucose in addition to ketones and fatty acids. Now, when I was racing ketogenically, I still used about a quarter of the amount of carbohydrate that my competitors were using because I used more ketones and amino acids, but you still need that glycogen throughput. And that amount of eating is just so hard on the gut because you're eating in that sympathetic state. So when someone's commuting in their car and eating, like picture that as the same state as a triathlete hammering a power bar while they're biking down the highway in 90 degrees. Like you're creating the same gut permeability scenario, or at least something that's somewhat synonymous.
That's Did you, how many years did you do each? Like, did you do like fat adapted?
Yeah, training? I did traditional like Gatorade Sports Science Institute recommended 60% to 85% carbohydrates up to a 95% carbohydrate intake on race week to load, which I was accustomed to because prior to that I was a bodybuilder, and the best way to get super swole on stage is after you've done your morning weigh-ins during which you're fully cramping and because you're dehydrated and glycogen depleted. And I'd like weigh in at 180 pounds that morning and do my posing and stuff where all the judges are. But then typically with bodybuilding, it's in the evening when you do your full on like pose off with all the people in the audience cheering and between like the 8 a.m. pose and the 6 p.m. show, I would go and punish like waffles, potatoes, ice cream, all the carbohydrates I hadn't been eating for weeks on end. I would gain easily in a day, like 10 to 15 pounds of water and glycogen weight. My muscles would just be popping through my skin. I'd look super swole on stage. And so I was accustomed when I got to Ironman of this concept of deplete carbs somewhat. And by deplete carbs, what I mean is when I was following the standard recommendations, like eat 60% carbohydrate intake, but then get up to like 85, 90% carbohydrate intake by the time that the day of the race was. And so I did that for like 6 or 7 years and had like really bad gas and really bad bloating. And even though I didn't test for it at the time, probably had SIBO, which a ton of endurance athletes especially have who are following those basic carbohydrate recommendations, fluctuating blood glucose levels, fluctuating it. Like all of this led to me writing my first book, Beyond Training, because I was trying to like hack these issues and figure out what was going on. So I got into the world of self-quantification and testing, and I performed really well on carbs because there's a saying like sugar is a sometimes drug. And it can be a super, super effective performance enhancing aid, especially if you've been low carb and then you introduce carbs in the equation, like you feel like you're on steroids. But the problem, of course, was all the metabolic and longevity side effects of that amount of carbohydrate throughput. So then I started to experiment with low carbohydrate intake with ketosis. I kind of had an extrinsic motivator because Dr. Jeff Volek asked me to be part of the FASTER study at University of Connecticut.
Zach Bitter was part of it too, right?
Yes, Zach was a part of it. And I was one of the selected ketogenic athletes. Mm. So for 12 months, I followed a strict ketogenic diet, 90% fat, like full a traditional on ketogenic, keto, like a traditional, which I think for athletes, a lot of times there's a mistake made because we're told ketogenic diet is 30 to 40 grams. When in fact, the research to date shows that endurance athletes stay in ketosis at a carbohydrate intake of up to 300 grams per day. But for this particular study, I was closer to like probably about 50, maybe 60 grams. I remember that when I went in for that study, the 3 hour treadmill run meal that they gave me was like 2 strawberries in like 6 ounces of heavy cream.
Wow.
Right. And which for me, the fat profile was accurate, but that was like not enough calories. Like, it was just nothing. So anyways, I did that study And of course, during that study, I was still racing and everything and applying a lot of what I was learning in my training, using everything from exogenous ketones to amino acids to higher intake of electrolytes, just because your electrolytes get more stripped when you're stripping glycogen mm-hmm. from your body. And it kind of got to the point where I figured out how to feel really good on that fueling approach. Although after the study, I shifted into more of a cyclic ketotic approach with evening carbohydrate refeeds. Mm-hmm. The reason being that my performance was better. Although with the evening carbohydrate refeeds, I was able to be in ketosis and be burning fatty acids for most of the day, briefly foray out of it. And by the next morning I was at like 3 millimolar ketones because I was so fat adapted. And the other reason that I made that modification was because during those 12 months of preparing for Jeff Volek's study, my TSH went through the roof. My free T3 and T4 and total both plummeted. Mm. My testosterone went to a state of hypogonadism. Mm. And a lot of that was because I had enough calories. I wasn't energy restricted, but I did not have enough glucose to go around at all.
Did you have enough protein?
Yeah, I think I did. Did I have a decent amount of protein, I was probably at about 0.6 to 0.8 grams per pound of body weight, which I think was enough protein. And I was supplementing pretty heavily with amino acids at the time due to advice that Peter Attia gave me when I bonked during one of my races. I called him up on the phone and we had a chat because he was kind of experimenting with a lot of this stuff at the same time that I was. And he had been kind of using branch chain amino acids. So I started to use the BioSteel branch chain amino acids that he recommended during a lot of my training sessions. And because I was training so much, that's a lot of amino acids that you're taking in if you're training like 2 hours mm-hmm. a day. And then I also met another guy named Dr. David Minkoff, who was more of a proponent of, instead of using the branched chain amino acids, leucine and isoleucine and valine, he instead was getting better results for both health and performance with his clients and his athletes doing all 9 amino acids, like the 9 essential amino mm-hmm. acids. So I started doing that instead. And I got so into the effects, like the multitude of effects that the essential amino acids had, that wound up being one of my flagship products at Keon. I was just using them so much. That's the way I formulate a lot of my supplements. I'll like scratch my own itch and then figure out how to like tweak it and refine it and turn it into a product. And so, from a protein standpoint, I think I was getting enough, and I was using a hefty amount of essential mm-hmm. amino acids too.
Interesting. Then what was the results of the study? Like, what did the faster study show? I don't really remember the big takeaways?
The big takeaways were, it was such an interesting study because I showed up to the UConn lab the day prior to the 3-hour treadmill run, which was mm-hmm. kind of like the big part of the test, obviously, for endurance, because this was a study specifically on the effects of a ketogenic diet on endurance performance in ultra endurance mm-hmm. athletes, primarily ultra marathoners and Ironman athletes. And the day before were muscle biopsies. And so they were looking at the composition of the muscle itself, which involves a guillotine-like needle plunged into the quadriceps and the hamstrings to extract muscle. So you're very bruised the next day while you're doing that 3-hour. Every time my foot would strike the treadmill, there'd be a little grimace. Mm. And then they did basically every 15 minutes during the treadmill run blood draws to analyze what the blood metrics were doing. And that would include blood glucose, fatty acids, et cetera. They did a VO2 max test, maximum oxygen utilization to exhaustion test, the evening prior. And then they did a stool, like a microbiome test. Mm. There was nothing that earth shattering about most of the results, from like a microbiome standpoint or many of the blood standpoint. Aside from the fact that both groups were pretty equivalent as far as the VO2 max was concerned.
Another group was a traditional high carb.
What's that?
Was the other group a traditional high carb?
Well, they would just say a traditional, not a traditional high carb. But yeah, traditional by the way that you and I would judge things would certainly be high carb. But what they found was that the ketogenic diet did not offer any any substantial improvements in performance versus the traditional diet, but there was also no average decrement in performance either. So it was a wash, but that's from a performance standpoint. And I would argue that it's not a wash from a metabolic health standpoint, provided that you maybe modify that ketogenic diet in the way that I did after the test, which would be to not restrict carbohydrates to the extent to where you're getting some physiological blowback. They also found, and I think this would be advantageous also for the ketogenic diet, that the endurance athletes who were following the ketogenic diet had, and this was based on the muscle biopsy, better glycogen conservation mechanisms. We actually developed the ability to be able to hold on to carbohydrates better in muscle. They didn't analyze liver because a liver biopsy would have been super painful, but they analyzed the muscle, and we were storing our carbohydrates more efficiently, or at least not burning through our carbohydrate stores quite as much, which makes intuitive sense because we were burning fatty acids and ketones more readily. I don't recall what the microbiome effects were. I mean, I would imagine to be a shift just because there always is when you're consuming carbs versus fat in the microbiome profile. But the main thing was, it doesn't help you performance wise, but also doesn't hurt you.
Well, I mean, that's big because people just think, they assume you have to have carbs to do these type of events.
Right. And if they would have repeated that test on a highly glycolytic audience, let's say, and by highly glycolytic, I don't mean like a power lifter or a volleyball player or a tennis player, but more like a CrossFitter or someone who is engaged in efforts that are repeated and that are longer than about 30 seconds in duration, which is the point at which you begin to burn an appreciable amount of carbs. So let's say like people who are doing like 30-second to 2-minute hard efforts as part of their sport, they probably would have seen, because studies since then have shown this to be the case, that a ketogenic diet does not allow for as good of a performance if you're engaged in a highly glycolytic sport like that, simply because you're burning a lot of carbohydrates. But what I would like to see, and I don't know if this has been done, would be, okay, well, what if you go maybe not full on traditional ketogenic, but like low carb versus traditional. So maybe you're having like 200 grams or even 300, which this would shock a lot of ketogenic, but 300 is still considered low carb. And I would imagine that if you just kind of shift ketogenic to be slightly higher carb, you wouldn't see any performance decrements in CrossFitters and stuff either. And that, you know, when I've done like Spartan racing, which is kind of like CrossFit, I've certainly found that to be the case. Like, cause when I did 4 years of Spartan racing, I was low carb the whole time, just doing like evening carbohydrate refeeds. Yep. And I was fine from a glycolytic standpoint.
And then on race day, would you use carbs?
On the, for the Spartan race days?
Yeah.
Yes, but similar to my Ironman approach.
Just less.
Like way less of what would normally be recommended, with a super easily digested carbohydrate. And for me, rather than the traditional approach of using like a gel that's typically fructose and maltodextrin, two highly fermentable carbohydrates, which aren't good for people who have gut issues, or using like the sweeter, like glucose-based blends, or you know, something like even something like the Yukan superstarch, which a lot of ketogenic athletes use, but which is also highly fermentable. And so you get a lot of gas and bloating after your event that I just couldn't handle. What I found worked best was a potato based starch. So I would use, brands, for example, like Vitargo or GlycoFuse, which allows for like a high glycemic index, but easily digestible carbohydrate to be consumed during exercise. But I would use like a quarter of what they recommended per hour, which I think came out to like around 100 calories or so of carbohydrates per hour. And then I would have like a shot of ketone esters or ketone salts and about 5 to 10 grams of amino acids and electrolytes. So I was essentially filling in the carbohydrate gap with ketones, amino acids, and electrolytes instead of carbohydrates, with a trace amount of carbohydrates. And that worked really well. And the only modification of that was that for something like an Ironman triathlon, using that fueling approach, I still found that towards the very end of the race, when you're about to go, like at about the 13 mile mark of an Ironman, like you really put your pedal or your, put your foot to the pedal, like pedal to the metal.
Yeah.
And just like everything you have left for the next, you know, anywhere from, you know, 70 to 90 minutes, depending on how fast you're running that, that last 13.2 miles, I would
be going very fast and going to the brink of exhaustion at that point. And all I did at that point was, you know, quit drinking the ketones and the amino acids and everything. And I would just drink Coca-Cola. All the aid stations had Coke. It was the perfect thing. It was like caffeine, sugar, yeah. Cold. And so for like the last slightly more than an hour of the race, it would just be like pure sugar. But at that point, it just hits you really, really well because you've not been using that up until that point. And so for Ironman, like there was a certain point where I'd switch to just like full on sugar at the very, very end.
All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
I did a pentathlon in the Masters Championships. So without even eating, I did fasted. I don't even know why I did it. I just did it as a goof, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm going to train for another one, the decathlon, do all 10 events in 2 days.
Oh, wow.
So I used to be a pole vaulter. So I was like,
wow,
if I can pole vault, that's the hardest event. Yeah. And, I can, yeah. So I just did it fasted, but I think I'll kind of do that approach, like using carbs next time on the day, but train pretty fat adapted.
But isn't the decathlon pretty, I guess what you would call phosphagenic, meaning most of the efforts are like 10 to 30 seconds.
They are. They're very short. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, well, they do have a 1500. So it's basically a mile.
Oh, there's a 1500.
Okay. Yeah. But there's 100, 1500. There's hurdles. There's javelin, shot put, discus, long jump. They have all kinds of stuff. I don't think it was optimum the way I did it, but I don't know. I just kind of was messing around.
Well, you know, for something like that, I would certainly supplement with creatine for sure. You know, and you get creatine from muscle meat, but like just using a good like 5 to even 10 grams. Mm-hmm. If you haven't been using it at this point, I wouldn't use it now, but you know, in future events, you know, loading with creatine could not loading with it, but using it consistently, like every morning, 5 grams. And then you could use some like your race or your event morning fuel could be something like some sweet potato or something like that to top off the energy stores just a little bit. But a couple of ideas. I picked this up from a guy named Steve. I forget his last name. He worked for Hammer Nutrition. Basically, his argument was that prior to an event, if you eat a meal that's higher in carbohydrates, based on the equation, I forget, you might know this. What's the metabolic theory that the body will shift into substrate utilization based on the predominant substrate you are consuming? Like if you consume carbohydrates, you're going to burn more carbs in the acute phase afterwards. If you eat more fats, you'll burn more fats in the acute phase afterwards. I did a whole podcast way back when with a gal about this, and she had a whole article about it. Now I'm forgetting the name of the equation. Anyways, it's not even that important, but aside from the fact that I'd sound really smart if I could remember what it was, but it's that damn kava or kratom.
Oh, maybe it's slowing my down. Head's like a little floating.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I feel like I've had maybe like 3 cocktails right now. So hopefully this isn't too shitty of a podcast for people. But anyways, what his theory was that if you eat a high carbohydrate meal prior to an event, then you risk shifting yourself towards a state of carbohydrate utilization so effectively that you almost get like a post-meal hypoglycemic drop due to the insulinogenic response to the carbohydrates. And that therefore what you should do if you are going to consume carbohydrates during is for your pre-event meal, have something that's higher in fat. And this is actually what I started doing for Ironman, such as for me, it was just like a fatty coffee, right? With you know, a butter or coconut oil and, you know, and some cinnamon and salt, you know, it's like a traditional fatty coffee type of approach. I'd say the actual B word for the actual coffee, but I don't want a cease and desist order for us using that without the trademark. So we'll just go with B coffee.
Fatty coffee. Yeah.
Actually, I think I can go with this because it's not trademark. Dave Asprey's wonderful, remarkable recipe for coffee. And so when I would use that, basically I would be able to keep myself in fat burning mode. And then once the event began, and the hypoglycemic issue was not as much of an issue because you become a lot more like insulin sensitive and don't need as much insulin released once you're actually exercising. That's the approach that worked really well for me. So it was like, don't have any carbohydrates until the event actually begins and then start having your carbohydrates. And that worked pretty well. So yeah, that'd be something to think about too.
For the event. I'm interested in just longevity, I guess. I think everyone's kind of interested in that. And so you're talking about the carb refeed at night. This is kind of what I landed on as the best way to do a diet, I think. And I want to get your take.
Okay.
So it's like you're fat adapted. You may maybe, you know, get fat adapted for a period of time, but then add in the carbs back in at night. And I just think you kind of get the best of both worlds. What do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, not only do you get the best of both worlds for the reasons that I dictated earlier, meaning that you top off your carbohydrate levels, yet still are in a relative state of fatty acid utilization the majority of the 24-hour cycle, with a brief foray out of ketosis and fat burning due to that evening carbohydrate refeed, right? You can ensure that you more rapidly return to a state of fatty acid utilization by engaging in or consuming something that would be a glucose disposal agent or that would cause you to be more insulin sensitive prior to that evening carbohydrate refeed. And for that, the best thing is prior to your dinner, that's going to include carbohydrates. You would do either a weight training session or a high intensity interval training session or cold thermogenesis or you would consume a glucose disposal agent like berberine or bitter melon, or even like if you were out at a restaurant, you go up to the bar and just order a bunch of bitters on ice. That's also a good hack if you don't have anything on you. Ceylon cinnamon, apple cider vinegar, you know, any of these traditional GDAs, probably the best one right now being dihydroberberine, which is a form of berberine that, seems to work very well. Or tooting my own horn, the product I developed is a the Keon Lean, where that's why I use Keon Lean, which is bittermelon extract, chromium, and vanadium. And, you know, anything like that prior to that evening carbohydrate refeed is going to make you able to return to your state of fatty acid utilization much better. Plus the carbohydrates that you consume with dinner allow for a greater serotonin response to the carbohydrates, thus resulting in better sleep due to the melatonin upregulation that occurs from the carbohydrate feed. And then, as if that weren't enough advantages of this, the other cool thing is, when you have carbohydrates for your evening meal, you tend to allow yourself to be more social, right? Because what's the most social meal of the day typically? The one where you might be going out to dinner or having a meal with the family where there's four different food groups on the table, some of which contain carbohydrates. What's the meal that might be the least, I guess, in your control if you are going out to a restaurant or to someone's house for dinner? Well, it's dinner. So why not hack your day or engineer your day such that dinner would be the most macronutrient flexible meal for you? Because if you're one of those people, like a lot of people are, who has total control of and less like social effects on your breakfast and your lunch, you know, and for me, my breakfast and my lunch every day is like the same thing. You know, breakfast is like a kind of like a ketogenic superfood smoothie, and lunch is like a salad with some fish or you know, nuts or whatever. Then by saving all your carbohydrates for dinner, you're making yourself just a funner person to be around socially and not feeling like you got to go to a steakhouse and just order like a stick of butter and some steak.
Well, this is great because this is like the best of all worlds. Yeah, this is what I've been trying to think about forever. And it's like you have a longevity mode for, say, 21 hours a day. I call it longevity mode, and then growth mode for, say, 3 hours a day. So I do my workout. So I'm in growth mode. I'm doing my workout, right? I'm doing like brief, intense exercise. I sprint. I do weights. I do weighted body weight, like dips and pull-ups with like 40 pounds. And then I eat, you know, a steak with some carbs. And I feel like that, yeah, just the best of all worlds.
Perfect example. Last night I went to Arlo Gray at my hotel. Paul Saladino and Luke Story and Stefano Sifandos and I had dinner. I love to have dinner with people. All three of those guys have been on my podcast.
Yeah.
And it's fun because what winds up happening, you know, opening the kimono for our listeners is like, when people who have podcasts together get together, it's almost like the podcast just keeps going and we keep talking about all this crazy shit at dinner. And so I was working during the afternoon. I knew I had dinner. I took a peek at the menu, as I'm prone to do, just to see, you know, what is going to be available to order. And I saw some things that, you know, like, sweet corn and carrot, Texas tomato salad with sourdough bread, you know, like a watermelon gazpacho, like some elements of the menu that dictated that, you know, I was like, oh, okay. So there's some decent carbohydrate option and they're not, it's all Twinkies and donuts. So I'll have carbs tonight for sure. And, prior to that dinner, I dropped into the gym. I did a 5x10 deadlift. I took a cold shower. I grabbed my lean and I went to dinner and I ordered a bitters forward cocktail with dinner. And so all of those things just shifted me into a state where, you know, I could punish a bunch of sourdough bread and stuff. And I'm not wearing my continuous glucose monitor on this trip. I wear it for about a week out of every month or so. But I guarantee that by doing all that stuff before dinner, like I'm super carb sensitive. And it's not as though you're like, people are probably thinking, oh my gosh, you just turned dinner into like an hour and a half long preparatory affair by the time I exercise and do my cold shower. But what I'll do is I'll just say, okay, well, you know, part of my workout today, you know, if I'll just like shorten the morning workout and make the evening workout, you know, a little bit longer or something like that. So, you know, as long as you think ahead and you like plan ahead, I think the carbohydrate refeed strategy works really well.
I think it's the best way to live. I did two meals a day. I just like to eat a lot in two meals instead of three. But man, okay, so I was gonna bring up alcohol. So if people do we got
a long time ago.
Way long time ago. Okay. So for alcohol, if you're gonna drink, I mean I like to drink socially, right? It's like I know some people in the health community, they're just like, I don't drink at all. I'm so healthy. I'm like, I appreciate that, but I do like to be social and have a drink on the weekends, and I'll do tequila and soda water. mm-hmm. is my go-to. But so if do you have any other like tips for people who, if they do drink, how to, what to do before or after?
Yeah, for sure. hide your car keys. No, well, when you say drink, because let me say this, what I don't want to do, and I sometimes question if I should have done this in my book Boundless. I have like two pages. That's like the party protocol, mm-hmm. or the Vegas protocol, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it, where it's basically like, okay, so you're going to go Taiwan on and mm-hmm. you're going to like have a lot to drink. Here's mm-hmm. what to do. And it's everything from like the charcoal tortillas mm-hmm. in the morning to the glycine and the activated charcoal and everything by the bedside and the electrolytes and a glass of water for every glass of alcohol that you mm-hmm. consume, and ideas for the cleanest burning stuff like tequila or vodka or gin or organic wine versus like a margarita mix or a super sugary protocol. Like it's all in there, right? We can mm-hmm. fill up like an hour with those couple yeah. of pages in the book. But the reason that I sometimes question that is I'm just like, I just don't endorse drunkenness. You know, I value sobriety, and part of that is because, well, it's multifold. A, I'm a Christian and the Bible has told me to be sober and to not be in a state of drunkenness. And I think that's wise, just because we don't want a bunch of people out like beating their spouses and poisoning their livers. And
we don't want drunkenness, but like crazy. Have a couple drinks.
And by the way, I should note that because I have a big article coming out about this on my website tomorrow, actually. Mm. When I say that I value sobriety, some people like, okay, but you've done ayahuasca and you've journeyed with psilocybin and you've used plant medicines and that's being drunk. I don't think that you can. I think if you take a ceremonial plant medicine in the mm-hmm. proper set and setting, and it's highly controlled and for a specific intention, and it's not, you know, some crazy party where you're going mm-hmm. into the K-hole or something like that, mm-hmm. I don't equate that to drunkenness. Mm-hmm. And I think that the spirit of, you know, any wisdom given in the Bible or elsewhere about valuing sobriety is dictating that, because you don't want a bunch of drunk, irresponsible people wandering the streets. I think like makes doing sense. Ketamine in a doctor's office under close supervision, or like doing a psilocybin, yeah. you know, facilitated psilocybin journey, you know, in a highly controlled setting. I don't think that's drunkenness, but anyways, yeah. rabbit hole. But back to, you know, you're having a couple drinks. So first of all, I think that of course the clean burning alcohols are super, super important. So that means if you're a beer person, you make sure you're drinking, you know, organic non-GMO based grains. There are even some wheat free versions of beer that you can have, you know, mm-hmm. some of the gluten free stuff tastes kind of crappy, but you know, go as organic as you can with selected ingredients on beer. For wine, go with something very similar to like the dry farm wines approach, mm-hmm. where it is low irrigated crops that have not been subjected to as much water and grown in a traditional European biodynamic type of style, mm-hmm. you know, old world wines because they don't get as much water, they have lower amounts of sugar, slightly lower amounts of alcohol. The grape is more concentrated in antioxidants. So like an organic biodynamic wine. And if you're out drinking and you don't know, and organic and biodynamic isn't on the menu, then Italy, France, and New Zealand are the three countries that tend to still use primarily organic mm-hmm. and biodynamic methods. And, you know, shout out to dry farm wines, because that's the majority of the wine that we drink at our house. And I just get a case of that sent to my house.
I had some of it last night. Yeah.
Yeah. And then aside from that, tequila, vodka, and gin are all pretty clean. They burn pretty clean. They're not like, you know, stay far away from mixes like margarita or seltzers or like any of these pre-made cheerleader drinks, as my wife calls them, that are just mm-hmm. super duper sugary.
Oh, yeah.
You just lost all your cheerleader listeners, chance. By the way. Yeah. And then, if I'm having, more than a couple of drinks, then something that will mop up some of the, like the acetaldehyde mm-hmm. and the ethanol, and that would be activated charcoal or chlorella. Glycine can also work pretty well for both vegetable oils and for alcohol as like a hack, like 2 to 4 grams of glycine, which is nice also because glycine will lower your body's core temperature prior to sleep. And so that can also help with sleep. And then, there is an extract that is remarkable at that post drinking morning haze that just like cleans out your system, and it acts very similar to what I would have recommended in the past, which would be like N-acetylcysteine or glutathione for helping your liver to detox the alcohol. Mm-hmm. You can take that the night of or the morning after or both. But there is another supplement that Sean Wells turned me on to, and I'll find it because I just started using it this past month. Let me look up the name of this. It's like a raisin extract. Dr. William Seeds, who I interviewed on my podcast about peptides, he had developed something called a chill pill, which was kind of similar to the ingredients in this one, but it's called dihydromyricetin. I can only find one company that makes it called Super Smart. But about three capsules of that in the morning, like just beats the pants off glutathione, N-acetylcysteine, anything else I've tried in that respect. So, you know, that and just that's hydration. Cool. The other thing that I always travel to bars with, in my fanny pack, actually, unless your dog just ate them, in which case I don't have them any longer, is some type of really good, like tasty electrolyte blend. You know, like Rob Wolf has his company, Element. I've been using this one made by a guy I interviewed on my podcast a couple months ago, a Navy SEAL named Nick Norris. He developed this really tasty electrolyte blend that has lemon and raspberry called Protect. And then in a pinch, I guess pun intended, I'll also just sometimes have a little Ziploc bag with a really good salt. And so I'll typically order in between my drinks sparkling water on ice, and I'll add electrolytes to it and or salt. And then the other thing that I add to it is hydrogen tablets, which are a really good anti-inflammatory and antioxidant. So typically I'll have like, let's say I'm going to have three cocktails. Cause, and for me, that's a party, baby. Like I'm going off the rails by having three cocktails. And so I'll like have a cocktail, like a really good bitters forward, you know, vodka, gin, tequila, whatever, and then have electrolytes with a hydrogen tablet, then have a cocktail, then have electrolytes with a hydrogen tablet, then a cocktail, then electrolytes with a hydrogen tablet, get back to the hotel or the room or wherever, pop some charcoal or some chlorella, or some glutathione or that dihydromyricetin I just talked about. The next morning, same thing, glutathione, dihydromyricetin, and that's a basic protocol.
That's good. Helpful. And I heard vitamin E is a good hack. If you're going to eat at a restaurant, there might be seed oils and that type of thing, that if you have a vitamin E in your pocket, it'll help kind of protect.
Yeah. Vitamin E is a pretty good solution for everything from, you know, controlling the formation of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in response to high fructose or high alcohol consumption to sorry, I just blanked that darn kava kratom. Feel free. Okay. What was the compound we were just talking about? It was, not glycine. You just named it. What were we talking about?
I don't know. Vitamin E.
Vitamin E. Okay. Yeah. we should
we're back.
We should leave this in there just so the listeners can chuckle. This isn't quite to the level of like Tim Ferriss when he drunk dials his listeners. I'm hoping hoping we're still giving lucid advice here. Yeah. So anyways, vitamin E can help with that. It's a pretty good antioxidant too. High doses post exercise you want to avoid because they can blunt some of the mitochondrial and hormetic response to exercise. But in the scenario of a toxin like alcohol, or a high intake of fructose.
Or specifically seed oils too.
Or seed oils, it could be helpful. Probably, I would say if you're going to take vitamin E, get a good blend of both the tocopherols and the tocotrienols. Like a lot of vitamin E, it's just like one or two of the tocopherols. One plant-based compound called annatto, and the company Designs for Health has a pretty good version of this. Their annatto is like all four tocopherols and all four tocotrienols. I think that Thorne's vitamin E product is similar in that respect. So basically what I'm saying is not all vitamin E is created equal. Make sure you get a good one. Vitamin E for that or for vegetable oil exposure. And then Dr. James Nicolantonio had a research paper that came out a couple of years ago in which he showed that spirulina and also glycine, which I mentioned earlier, are both very effective at controlling some of the oxidative and cell membrane damage that occurs in response to vegetable oil consumption. So let's say you're eating that you know, granted it's cold expeller press canola oil, non-GMO, a little bit better than your average canola oil at Whole Foods, right? Mm-hmm. And you're at the Whole Foods salad bar and you're dishing up your plate and everything, then just like swing through the supplement section and grab some glycine and or some spirulina. And you can have that after you've had the canola oil, and it's going to control and kind of like mop up some of the damage.
Okay. I like this. So I'm making the film. We were talking about food lies. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, yeah, like put everything you've ever learned, I've ever learned, we've all ever learned into one film. What do you think are the biggest problems? Like, I'm always interested in like, how did we get in this mess, right? How, mm-hmm. why is 88% of Americans, you know, mm-hmm. metabolically unwell? And so what message would you put in a film? Like, mm-hmm. what are the, I was telling you what I was going to do. What we're saying, meat is a health food, mm-hmm. and we're saying avoid the processed mm-hmm. refined grains, sugars, and seed oils. Like, do you think that that's it? Like, how do you boil it down? You know, there's so much going on. Right. There's so many theories. Like, what do you think it is?
We could dish out theories till the cows come home, mm-hmm. even though I don't know what that means because mm-hmm. I'm not a farmer or a mm-hmm. rancher, and I've never quite understood that analogy or metaphor or saying. And we could kind of like do the whole echo chamber thing that every other podcast on the face of the planet is doing, like eat real food, don't have vegetable oils, be careful with excess sugar, yada, yada, yada. Like, we know. Thank you. But here's where I feel that the disconnect lies, because I have children. There's still a prevailing, almost like this prevailing fault or philosophy, especially in parenting, where you don't want your kid to be weird, and you want your kid to grow up like having the life that a lot of other kids have. Mm-hmm. Like, you grew up in America, like you gotta have had a Big Mac, and you gotta have gone to In-N-Out Burger, and like, what, you've never had a Twinkie? That's like a classic mm-hmm, American mm-hmm. food. And oh my gosh, there'd be nothing better than after this, the 4th of July party than to do our traditional greasy pizza. Cause that's what our dad did. And that's what our grandpa did. And that's just like our tradition. And I feel like there's almost like this approach, especially amongst parents, because I see this a lot, is all the other kids are having cake, so it's okay to have cake too. Even though all the parents, when you talk to them, like at the party, they're like, yeah, I'm gluten free and I'm super healthy, but you know, let the kids be kids, like mm-hmm. let them have their, let them grow up, like, you know, enjoying all of our American comfort foods or enjoying whatever. If you're up here in Canada, like, you got to have poutine. And mm-hmm. so the problem is that I think we still have a lot of societal pressure to not be weird, to not deprive our children of having a normal upbringing. Mm-hmm. And so they should be able to have these foods to like it's going to be hard for us to say, okay, you're going to throw a birthday party, but at the birthday party, we're going to have like coconut ice cream and, you know, root beer floats made with like real sarsaparilla and, mm-hmm. you know, and wonderful, like more of the good stuff versus the junk food, because junk food is woven into culture as such a, like a tradition and mm-hmm. a go-to, that it's uncomfortable in many social scenarios to extricate that. And so I think really where it starts is parents educating their children to be themselves and do what they know is right and be educated about the consequences, including the metabolic food consequences of the decisions that they make, and to not be who the world expects them to be, and to be okay with being weird mm-hmm. and defying social norms, and when all like being actually like dad. And when you go to a birthday party where there's going to be cupcakes and stuff, you've got like a really good, like raw cacao dark chocolate bar slipped into your backpack mm-hmm. and you're going to have that while everybody else is having cupcakes. And this sounds trite, but in many cases, shifting a habit that's deleterious to a culture starts with parenting. It starts with the kids. And so, you know, if every parent were to just start to educate their children better and also tell their kids, look, it's okay
if you don't have cake. Like some of the other kids might think that's weird, but dad's going to take you out to ice cream tomorrow night. And here's a dark chocolate bar you can take to the party. Mm. And I think that that would make a bigger dent than a lot of people realize if we were to just get a lot of this junk food out of tradition, out of vernacular, out of expectations of what a child should be able to have the joy of experiencing through childhood. Because what happens is, you know, they finally turn like 25 and start to have some metabolic issues and start to look into healthy eating and healthy food and realize that what they've been doing for the past couple of decades was just swallowing hook, line and sinker what everybody else in society was doing because they needed to be cool or not be a social outcast from a food and drink standpoint. And if we can get kids to the point where rather than making a bunch of crappy mistakes and like fixing them later in life when it's finally time to lose weight because you're or whatever, or you're fix yourself because you're suffering metabolically, if you just never went through that phase, right? If you just grew up eating healthy food because that's what people do, then I think that would make a huge dent. Like it's just, it should be weird to have a Big Mac. Like if you're having a Big Mac, people should be like,
why would you do that?
Yeah. Like that's weird. Like that's like you're eating dog shit. And we have to get to that point in society.
That's the goal. But it's like, how do we get there? You got to teach people. Also, so I just came from beach volleyball. I'm getting sand all over my couch.
That's okay. I got to wrap pretty soon. Yeah. Anyways, I have to check out of my hotel soon.
That's true. So, I was going to say, so I talk to these people. They're like the normal people, right? So I'm hanging out with these beach volleyball people. I'm trying to tell them all the stuff, the health, you know, I'm sure you get into all these conversations and you're trying to download people on all this information. And they're just like, my thing is that you can give them all the information, but actually doing it is another thing. So this is what you're talking about. It's like how to actually live lifestyle. If you can know everything, but actually doing it is the hard part. Mm-hmm. And also, I think changing your community. You're talking about like changing parenting, but if your community of people around you do it, then you're not weird. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was trying to say. So now I'm in Austin, you know, I'm hanging with people that are like-minded, and now I am not the weird person because we have a barbecue and everyone just shows up with healthy food. Right. And so I don't know how to get there too.
Healthy food, comma, that is tasty and that's really good. And I think that when we hear this idea, and this has been shown in research that I don't want to fat shame, but like fat people a lot of times are fat because a lot of their friends are fat, or unhealthy people are unhealthy because the people they hang out with are also unhealthy. And then the healthy people hang out with the healthy people. So we have this rift in society, right? We have the healthy people hanging out with healthy people and the unhealthy or fat people hanging out with fat people. And what then needs to occur is you have to start inviting your unhealthy friends or your overweight friends to the same type of events, but just make sure they're always outnumbered. Right. Mm. And like, that's what I love about the dinner parties that I throw at my house is, you know, I'll have somebody at the party who is not accustomed to eating healthy food that's actually tasty. They think they're accustomed to like, what's the bodybuilding meal? Broccoli and chicken, what they call brickin, right? They're accustomed to brickin being like healthy food, like giving my lean chicken breast with no oil and no salt on it and some unflavored broccoli that's steamed and maybe a little bit of white rice on the side. And they'll show up to my house and it's like a coffee and cacao rubbed fatty ribeye steak and a glass of organic wine and like, you know, some type of like amazing natural gluten-free carrot cake and some like baked sweet potato fries along with the meat. And people eat that and they're like, how do you not gain weight on this food? Like, how is this healthy? And I'm like, God actually made some really great like ingredients. And when prepared properly, like you can eat really, really well. And yeah, you still need a certain amount of self-control. Let's face it. At the end of the day, like calories in, calories out, like there's a lot to be said for that equation. And you can get fat on ribeye steak just the same.
If you eat like 10 pieces of that carrot cake.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. But that's kind of the idea too, is you want to do what you're doing, Brian, but then bring people who are unhealthy or who aren't accustomed to that into the crowd, into the circle. And then, you know, then they go out to their friends and, you know, and we just start to spread the word.
Well, that's how to make it sustainable. I always try to spread this message of I'm so lucky to that I found this and get to eat this food, right? It's like every meal to me is amazing treat. And if people knew that, that they could have an amazing treat as a healthy mm-hmm. meal, then maybe they'd actually do it, right? Yeah. It's like the, yeah.
That's why I just wrote a cookbook.
Did you? I'm writing a cookbook too.
I promise that's my last shameless plug. Yeah. I think that education is a big part of it, but education with love. With shaming. Yeah, and acting on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have another plug. I gave you this biltong. You can take it on the plane.
Thank you.
So my Nose to Tail company makes this biltong.
I'll hold it up for your camera.
Yeah.
Grass-fed beef. And then biltong it's kind of like jerky, but it's more like dense and moist, right?
Well, yeah, it's slow air dried instead of like baked at a high temperature to dehydrate like jerky. So it's softer.
Wow. So, this looks really good. And I'm going to totally punish this on the plane.
Go for it. Yeah, I know you got to go, but next time we could play some volleyball. I didn't know you played volleyball back in the day.
I did. I played middle for University of Idaho. So I was a short middle at 6'2", but back then I had hops until I got into endurance sports and converted a lot of my fast switch into slow twitch. But I still like me some twos or threes on the beach for sure. So I'm
Let's
in next time. I'm going to be back in Austin in October for my friend Joe DiStefano's Runga event. And I'll hang out for a few days and we'll definitely get some beach volleyball in as long as you promise to go to a little cold swim at Barton Springs with me.
I'll do that. It's great to jump in after. Good stuff, man.
Game on.
Good meeting you at Paul's. We crushed some cornhole. I think we won 15-0.
We beat Paul Saladino and his girlfriend 15-0. So they probably should have had more plants prior to that game. I guess the last thing is we should title this podcast like Drunken Banter or something like that. So again, my apologies to folks if I lost track there a few times during the show. I'm going to blame it on this feel-free plant-based tonic, but honestly it's not bad.
I mean, if you don't want to drink, we talked about alcohol. This is a pretty good alternative to alcohol. I feel like I'm buzzed.
Yeah, like I feel like I'm buzzed too. I think Khalil told me he was going to ship me a box of this stuff, so I'm going to what I like to do is sometimes find out what my ceiling doses. So I may try two or three of these, but I tell you what, it's a little bit different taking it and having a microphone in front of your face. Cause you get kind of self-conscious and you're like, do I sound drunk right now? Versus if you just drinking it at a dinner party and just chatting with a bunch of people. But yeah, shout out to these folks, Botanic Tonics, feel free. Maybe I'll see if I can hunt down a deal or something from them. And I'll send it over to you if I do. So thanks for having me on, man.
All right, man. I guess let's just wrap it up.
All right. See you, man. That's a wrap.
Boom.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.